All right. So this evening, we're going to talk about the pilgrimage that 15 of us made to Thailand, India, and Nepal last year in October and November, and then briefly about the next one that, if we get enough people, is scheduled for the same time period in 2016. So the format for tonight is I'm just going to give kind of a brief little overview of what the pilgrimage is and how we run it and how it's different from other pilgrimages. And then the pilgrims are just going to share their experiences, and this is just a completely uncensored night. None of us have any idea what the other one's going to say, and so I'm as interested as you are in what's going to happen tonight. So, okay, so the where this starts is the reason really that all of us are here is because of one person, and that's the historical Buddha. And his extraordinary ability to delineate so carefully a series of teachings and their underlying psychology of a way of living, of relating to each other. It's pretty extraordinary. And the mystic wing of every great religion has a meditative wing and a mindfulness wing, but of all of them, the Buddha is the one who was able to very clearly drill down and lay it out so clearly. So the Buddha said that if you were a dedicated and serious student of these teachings, that at least once in your lifetime there's three places you should go. And the three places were where he was born, where he died, and where he gave his first talk, where the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, which was in Sarnath, India. And it's easy to physically describe what happens, like where you go and what the format is of a pilgrimage, a Buddhist pilgrimage. It is very difficult to convey the potential impact that it has on people, because the effect is multidimensional, it's psychological, it's emotional, it all arises out of the experiences of the trip. And many people, and I'm sure some of the pilgrims will talk about this, the impact of it you actually don't realize for months, sometimes years later, because it starts things cooking in you. It stirs things up and it touches things very, very deeply in us. The common Buddhist pilgrimage, like if you look in Tricycle Magazine or other places, there's lots of people doing this. They're usually, 10, 12, 14 days, and they're kind of a whistle stop. You visit all of these key places. At each place, it's quite short. You go in, kind of do a sightseeing. Maybe there's a talk about what happened there, and then you're off to the next place. We don't do it that way. We call this a pilgrimage and a moving retreat. So the time period of the retreat itself is about 24 days. So it's a real commitment of time. And we try to be embedded right in the community of these various places where the Buddha lived and taught. And so rather than staying over on the other side of town where you could stay in a nicer accommodation, we try to stay in places that are like really, really close to the key sites. So in Bodh Gaya, the little hotel that we stay in, you walk out the door and turn to the left, and within 2.5 blocks you're actually in the grounds of the Mahabodhi Temple and the whole grounds where the Buddha was awakened and is one of the, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's one of the most sacred sites, religious sites in the world. And so the first half of the trip we stay in modest hotels. The second half of the trip we stay in monasteries. And that's modest. But the food is great every place. This trip was terrific. And the basic format is every place we go, Half of the day is basically practice. So, like you go to the Mahabodhi Temple or in Srivasti, where we know that the Buddha and all of this whole group of people that surrounded him, these fantastic teachers and awakened beings, they did at least 24 rains retreats there. So it's a very powerful place just to be on that ground and to know that, like, you know, the people depicted on this tanka were actually there. Like, you're sitting where they were sitting. Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinary experience. So we practice for a half a day. That usually involves sitting and walking meditation and a Dharma talk and a discussion. The afternoons, if we're not traveling or devoted to either as a group we go someplace or individually or in small groups, you can do kind of cultural exploration, exploring the community and different sites. At night, we have a session where we debrief the day. And there's something about India, and we're in northern India. This is all in northern India, which is the poorest part of India. It's largely undeveloped, and so many of the places that we go, my guess, are pretty close to the conditions that were there when the historical Buddha was alive, other than the fact that everything's been deforested, you know, with pollution and all kinds of other things. You know, that's pretty much all gone. But so it's all northern India, and even for seasoned travelers, you know, like on this last trip, we have people who, you know, are Peace Corps people, travel all over the world. You go to India, there's something about India that just blows you out. I mean, it's very, very powerful, the conditions there, and the poverty and beggars and the spirituality. And the pictures are already starting to fall down. Like, by even talking about this, they're starting to fall down. So every night we get together and kind of process the whole day, which I think most people would say is one of the richest parts of the trip, because by the end of a trip like this, there are 15 people total. And by the end of the trip, I mean, you really know these people. And you know them in a different way than if you were coming together and meeting them here, because here we have all the things that are normally propping us up. You know, we get up in the morning and have our cup of coffee, or when we're going to work, it's a latte, and, you know, we drive our car, and we go here on Tuesdays, and we go there on Fridays, and we have our favorite restaurants. All of that's taken away from you on a trip like this. And so you find out, or at least you have the potential of finding out who it is beyond all that stuff we're normally holding on to, all that stuff that's normally defining us, which is the exciting part about a trip like this. So I'm getting ready to close, okay? The reason that I'm doing another one of these and want to lead these is that I know the impact that these trips have had on me. And before my first pilgrimage, I'd been practicing for a long time. And after that pilgrimage, my understanding of Buddhist practice and who I was as a person in relationship to Buddhist practice completely changed. I really look at my practice as before and after that pilgrimage. It was that significant for me. And this trip, much the same thing, but in a very specific way. Varanasi, India, which is the pictures that are directly back on the wall here, is where many of the photos that you see where people are in India are down these ghats in the water praying. Frequently those are of Varanasi, and this is where there are these very famous burning ghats, where bodies are cremated. And for a Hindu, Varanasi is the most holy city in the world, because it's believed that if you could die there, that you are guaranteed a favorable rebirth. And at the primary burning ghat, to even be burned there, your body has to be brought there within 24 hours of death. And then there's this whole process that takes place. And for Buddhists, Varanasi is a city that is rich in history in terms of metta, or kindness. A bunch of things have happened there that relate to that. So the first trip was, I spent quite a bit of time at the Burning Ghats because I wanted to understand it. And this trip, I spent a lot of time. And when everybody would go to sleep, then I would go down to the Burning Ghats at night. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty spectacular to go down, and at this particular ghat, there's space for 24 bodies to be burned. And, you know, with no artificial light. And to see 24 of these bodies burning, and then there's this whole process, and if you're just willing to stay with it, what you start to see is the balance and the wholeness and the beauty of this particular culture holding beginnings and endings, birth and death, all in one piece rather than separating them. And you see people honoring death in a completely different way than you see it happen here. And so this could be a long story. So I'm just going to give you the conclusion. The conclusion may not work without the whole story. But for me, much like the first trip with respect to Buddhist teachings, this time, this trip, and particularly my experience of Varanasi, caused this very deep fundamental shift, kind of a default setting of how I relate to beginnings and endings and losses and death. So in the last week, I've had one member of my family and one member of my ex-wife's family die that I was very close with. And since coming back from the retreat, I've had a very large personal loss. And the way that I'm experiencing them is just like completely different. It's just, you know, and it's not any way you could think your way into. You know, there's just this fundamental shift that's taken place that arises out of the experience and the experience of doing it with a group of people. So for me, that's the possibility of this and the excitement of it. You know, that's what I want to try to facilitate. In addition to which, this is just a hell of a lot of fun to do this. It's, you know, it can be very challenging. It can be a real struggle sometimes. You know, it can be trying. But overall, just a wonderful experience. So I'm just going to turn it over to the group now, and we can go in any order.
Okay. Well, as you will see, as I try to progress through what I'm going to say tonight, I'm pretty emotional about this pilgrimage. And when I get this kind of emotion, I tend to forget important points and to ramble. So bear with me while I use my cheat sheets and telling you the points that I wanted to do. I think most of the pilgrims would agree with me that the question that we're asked the most, is what was the high point of the pilgrimage? What were the high points? Or what was the spiritual lesson you learned, the spiritual lessons? And those are valid questions, but I have to say that I've not found the words to describe all the feelings and emotions and understandings that we experienced on this trip. There were certainly experiences and spiritual things that I'll mention in a couple of minutes. I think the major point I'd like to make here is that, from my perspective, the most powerful influence on me was the cumulative effect of the experiences and places. One way that I think we could see this is that the energy of the group and the actions of the group changed as the pilgrim progressed. And so that's there's all these individual things, but it's really the whole ball of wax. Okay, about specific places and experiences. And again, there are so many great experiences and places that for me to pick one or two was really difficult. And I really don't like to rank things because they're different anyway. I think most of the pilgrims would agree with Dennis that the Burning Ghats were a biggie for all of us. And boat rides on the Ganges River in Varanasi were great and very moving. And these boat rides, we came into Varanasi on a bus. And we happened to come in there at a time that they were having this major Hindu celebration of fertility, which was mainly for women and children. Varanasi is a huge, huge city. And there were additional thousands of people in Varanasi when we arrived that night. So we couldn't drive to our hotel. So we went to the river, got on a boat after dark, and rode the boat to our hotel. And here are all these people lining the shores of the river there for the celebration, because it starts at sunset and ends at sunrise. So we were on a long trip coming in, and then we took the boat, and that was a wonderful experience. The next morning, we got about 2 or 3 hours of sleep, and then we went and got on another boat before sunrise, because we wanted to be out on the river when the sun came up, and that's when that came. And so again, there were thousands and thousands lining the banks of the. So those are some experiences that are meaningful to me, and I think to most people. But what I'd like to move on to now is a couple of I guess what I call more simple personal experiences that I had on this trip. And one of them came in early in the trip, and the other one came toward the end of the trip. And as Dennis mentioned, the first place that we were was in Bodh Gaya, which is the place where they say that the Buddha was enlightened. And the central feature of Bodh Gaya is the Mahabodhi Temple, the temple grounds, and the Bodhi tree at the western end of that. And we spent 4 days in Bodh Gaya, and it was great. And on these grounds, there were hundreds, maybe thousands, of monks in different colored robes. There are these groups from different places. Some of them had their identifying white robes of whatever color, all meditating, walking, and it was just an incredible show. It was enchanting and thrilling. But for me, the first couple of days, I was kind of wondering, why am I not feeling this more deeply? This is where the Buddha awoke. And what's wrong with me? Should I not be in this trip or whatever? Fast forward to my last visit to the grounds, the temple grounds. And on that visit, I gravitated to the Bodhi tree. And the Bodhi tree is surrounded by a stone fence. It's pretty high, but it has these little peepholes that you can look in. And so, I went up to this fence, and I laid my forehead on the fence, and I put both of my hands on the fence, and I tried to open my whole body with awareness and ask my mind to be calm. And actually, fairly soon after that, this feeling of tranquility and gratefulness swept over me, and tears just streamed down my face, and these were tears of joy, and I think they were conditioned by some level of understanding of this thing that we're in. call the Dharma. So that's my first personal experience. The next one, it was an experience at Jetta's Grove. And Jetta's Grove is in a place called, a village called Srivasti. And this is where the Buddha offered the greatest number of his discourses. And for me, Srivasti seemed to be kind of a special place. I mean, every place was special, but this was very special for me. And the specific event that I want to relate to you was in Jetta's Grove, and it was a loving kindness meditation that was facilitated by Yana. And in this meditation, all or most of the pilgrims reveal what I would call really deep qualities of caring, kindness, and compassion that really moved me deeply. Thank you for that. And it was also the simplicity and depth of that I think was involved. Okay, I'm about done. Another question that I'm frequently asked is, how did the pilgrimage change your life, change your practice? And I guess first I would say that I'm still processing the experiences. But in brief, I would say that the experiences of the pilgrimage did a shift in my perception. I think my perceptions seem a little more close to reality, or some of them at least, and more balanced. And although I'm not reactive-free, surprise, surprise, I feel that I'm less reactive to some situations, and that might be considered unpleasant. And I feel that mindfulness is more efficient in discerning thoughts that come from unskillful and skillful mind states, such that I have a greater opportunity to make choices between unskillful and skillful actions. So that's my piece. Thank you for listening, and thank you, pilgrims, for your support and your love.
Actually, it came to me in the end of the sit just now, what has probably been sitting back there, which is that for me, the whole idea of going on this retreat was a tremendous actual act of faith. And faith has been a funny word, you know, for me, and I think for a lot of us, but I've been practicing for a while, and when Dennis said he was doing this retreat, I thought, I have to do this retreat. It was just like, I'm not even sure I'm really going to like it, but it somehow, on some level, didn't matter. It was just like, oh, this is the opportunity to do this, and it's now, and I want to do it. And it was a challenge from the beginning to the end. I mean, the whole getting ready, whether I was going to have enough money, whether I was going to make it to the meetings, whether I was going to, you know, all of my over, you know, wanting to make sure I had all the right clothes and the right stuff and the right, you know, all of that kind of thing. And then when we got there, all the preparation that we had done for, because we had a meeting every month, for like the whole, almost a year before we left. And so we knew each other pretty well, and we had shared some intimate feelings about our fears about going and all of that kind of thing. And so when the rubber hit the road, I think we were pretty darn prepared, and the rubber did hit the road. I mean, one of my strongest memories is sitting at breakfast, and I'll probably cry again because I do every time I tell the story, when we were in Bogaya, and I was starting to talk about a beggar child that I'd seen on the temple grounds, and I just lost it, and Yana reached across the table and grabbed my hand and held my hand until I could regroup again. It was, and we could do that for each other, you know? Like, a lot of us got in difficulty, and there was lots of hugs and lots of caring, and those sessions at night were invaluable, invaluable. And I realized tonight when I was getting dressed, I brought all my talismans with me. I bought my Bodhi bracelet from Bodh Gaya and my prayer wheel thing, little necklaces from Kathmandu, and the earrings that I wore that I never took off the entire time we were there. I wore very little jewelry and no makeup because, believe me, it didn't matter after the first couple of days. But the story I want to tell you is a leap of faith story, because we went to Sarnath, which is right outside of Varanasi, after we'd spent these four amazingly intense days, and we stayed, and it's only about 8 miles outside of Varanasi, but it felt like a whole completely different world. It felt like we were almost out in the country, and it was a monastery staffed by these amazingly sweet young Nepalese boys. I mean, they were monks, but they were just delightful. The power went out every night. It was clean and fresh. Not really fresh. The air was not fresh. The air was not fresh anywhere. But it was a very nice experience. And we could walk to the grounds where the Buddha gave his first talk, where the wheel was turned. And it's called the Deer Park, and there's actually still some deer there. And there are delightful dogs that lay on these warm brick walls while we're meditating. I have many pictures of Jana sitting by one, or Dennis sitting on the wall and the dog meditating along with us. And I have pictures in my mind of Gus walking around the stupa, because they put a stupa right where the talk was. And there's people that go and chant all day. There's signs everywhere that say, don't put gold foil on the monuments. And there's gold foil all over the monuments. And so we would walk, after we would sit in the morning, we would walk for lunch outside the grounds and then find a place for lunch. And then one afternoon, Dennis had mentioned that there was a Tonka store across from, there's a Jain temple, a place that's very sacred to the Jains, and across the street from the Jain temple. And everybody had been talking about these Tonka paintings, and I was like, oh well, I'm not that interested, but I'll go and I'll see. I think Jerry had bought one the night before or something like that, so some of us went. And I walked down into the place, and there were all these Tonkas all over the walls, and I was like, oh yeah, and then I saw this one. And I don't even know if any of you guys have ever seen it, because I basically bought it and they shipped it. But I walked into that room and looked at this painting and I went, oh. And I found out later it was painted by a pretty high master. And it just has wonderful qualities to me. But the funny leap of faith story is both having a painting and using it as a meditation device has to do with me, with devotion and faith. But then how I had to buy it is the story and the funny part that's India. So I wanted to buy it, didn't have the right number of rupees because I didn't carry that much cash on me. But no problem, the place next door had a card reader. All I needed to do was find the key from the guy who was off that day, open the key up, turn the thing on, and so of course he did that. We went in, and then the card reader didn't work. So then he had to go get a motorcycle from his brother. He borrowed his brother's motorcycle, and he said, well, we'll just go to an ATM. I had never met this guy until that day, right? And I thought, okay, I'll ride the motorcycle with the guy. So we go to an ATM. So, and I said, you know, we've been trying to find an ATM with money for days. And so the first ATM was out of money. The second ATM was out of money. I think the third ATM was also out of money. The fourth ATM had money, but it had 9 people in line. So we wound up cruising on the motorcycle all the way back to Varanasi. And the thing you don't understand, because you probably, if those of you who have not been here, is you're sharing the road with potholes, mud, because the monsoons had only been over for like 3 weeks, various animals, various big trucks full of stuff, people on bicycles, lots of motorcycles. I mean, it's just crazy, but he had a little motorcycle, and it was the best way to get around, because what the bus couldn't do that we were on was avoid the holes in the road. So anyway, we went all the way back to Varanasi And that ATM was out of money. So we had to come back to the one, wait in line. All the time, the guy and I are talking. And it turns out he's a delightful guy. He and his brother switch back and forth. They live in Kathmandu half the year and come back. They sell Tonkas. He wanted us to look him up when we got there. He has friends that he met that he corresponds with on Facebook in Miami. I mean, it's just hysterical. So eventually I got the money, was able to give him the money, and didn't even take a picture of this. Realized, you know, how do I know if he's even going to ship it to me? I paid the shipping charge, gave him my address, gave him a phone number, and when I got home, it was waiting for me. So it was very fun and very much an adventure. And very much like the whole trip, it had these elements of, this is definitely, I have no idea whether this is going to work. But what Dennis said is true about, so it works on you in a different way that you don't, I didn't do that much, you know, I sat, I tried to stay open, I tried to notice when I was closing off because things were scaring me, or I was feeling threatened, or I wanted to look at them in the way that I was used to looking at things. And we talked a lot about that, about feeling the clench when things would get hard, and trying not to do that. And I found that since I have been home over and over again, what happens when I get in any kind of a jam about anything is I think, what was it like in India? And you know, you said the hotels were modest. Maybe they were modest, but they were so much better than most of those people have that live there. When you see how fortunate we are, it's like impossible not to want to do. I want my heart to stay open, and I want, it's like the rubber really did hit the road. I really understand what's important now in a whole different way. And it isn't something that you can't put it in words. I tried. Thank you.
So the pilgrimage for me, kind of like Vanel was saying, when I saw that, I just said, I want to go, and I didn't care what happened. I just, and then I kind of used the excuse of turning 50 as being a birthday present for myself, you know, justify that I could go. for me, I think one of the main themes from the pilgrimage was that it showed me how about connection to just not the group. I mean, there's a lot of connection between the group, but also the Dharma and the wider Sangha, and kind of the world in a way. You know, kind of reconnected me with humanity in a way that I felt like I had lost over the years. So my recollection is from Bodh Gaya too, which was the first place that we were at, and it was the rhythm of the day, like Dennis was saying. We'd spend the morning together and we'd practice, and then in the afternoon we could do whatever, you know, we'd do whatever we wanted, and then we'd come back together in the evening. And one afternoon, Gus and I decided to go looking for a tanka. You know, we were like on a mission to find the tanka shop that was in Bodh Gaya. Well, that's what we heard. There was a tanka shop. We didn't really know if there was one, so we didn't really care. You know, it was just something to do. So we hired a tuk-tuk, which are these really little cute little cars that just zip all over the place. And we got in the tuk-tuk and we told the driver we were looking for a tanka shop, and said painting. And so the first little went on the little tuk-tuk, we went past Mahabodhi Temple, and there was a little shop that had paint, you know, to paint your house. And so we're like, okay, well then we gestured some more, like painting, you know, things you look at. And then off we went to another little shop, and this time the guy picked some like pictures of different Hindu deities, you know, Shiva and Ganeshi, to show us, and we were like admiring them, going, well, they're very nice, we're looking for Buddhist paintings. And so they talked a little while, You know, I mean, it was just, you know, they just talked and like, oh yeah, okay, so we felt like we, you know, we were making progress. And so off we went again. And I think, I don't even remember where we were, a couple of other places that were maybe some more Hindu paintings or Hindu posters. But, you know, that really wasn't, I mean, it was, that wasn't really the point. I just remember being in that tuk-tuk, and a lot of times we would just be taking in what was happening around us, you know, just taking in Bodh Gaya and just being quiet. You know, we didn't talk very much, just being quiet. And I think what started happening for me is that I realized that this connection to Bodh Gaya, to the Indian people, and the people, you know, like the tuk-tuk driver, which is so open-hearted and so generous. And then, you know, to Gus and the other pilgrims on the trip. So anyway, so then we went to a place that had Tibetan, like the ritual, this metal ritual ritual implement, and we looked at those. And then this was like 45 minutes later, you know, zipping around. And so we thought, okay, we should probably let him go, you know, so he probably has other things to do. And so we, you know, thanked him, and then he left. And then we wandered around, but Gaya some more, and eventually wandered back to the hotel. But so I guess, you know, my point is that it's the connection of just being able to be in the moment without really having expectations of what would happen, or really even caring what would happen, just being open and seeing where things led, just kind of nourished that connection to myself and to the experience.
As you can see, a lot of the experiences were very serious and profound, and a lot of them were very humorous. Before I talk about how the trip affected me, I do want to say that I may have been the only person that didn't buy a tanka. But I found one at a yard sale. A beautiful one, professionally framed for $20. So it's sitting right above my desk. I don't know the significance of it. Maybe someday I'll find a Tibetan teacher that can tell me, but it's all very, very intricate. Very intricate. Yeah. I thought, well, I guess I was supposed to have one after all. So. When I first heard about this trip, I had never ever thought about doing something like this. But I have a nephew who's a world traveler and loves India, has been there many, many times, and that kind of stuck in the back of my head that, well, you know, he goes back repeatedly and has wonderful experiences. Maybe there's something here for me. And I didn't quite understand the whole significance of pilgrimage. You know, had to learn all about that. My first thought was, can I do this? Physically, can I do this? I don't have the best back in the world. And I had a recent knee replacement. And constantly kind of saying, you know, am I going to be not, you know, I didn't want to be a burden to the group. I wanted to be able to do this. As it turns out, I was the oldest female in this group, which was new. I'm used to, you know, I'm going, when did that happen? I used to be how did I get to be the oldest in a travel group? So there was a bit of a leap of faith for me as well. But I really felt by the time we embarked that I was ready, and the preparation was, you know, we all wondered, why are we meeting for a whole year? Well, I truly understand now why we did that. Every phase, the packing, what to bring, how to approach various situations, all of that was worked out in advance, and that's what made it possible for me to enter into this experience without much fear at all. And I have to say that I had a lot of emotions on the trip, but fear was not one of them. Every experience was, you know, was different, was exhilarating, and I did feel prepared. And one of the things I did in preparation was to think through very, very deliberately what my intentions were for this trip. And, you know, I went in knowing that I wanted to be mindful as much as I could during the trip and focus on that, and that I wanted to practice compassion and generosity and equanimity. And I will tell you, there's ample opportunities to practice all of those things everywhere you go. And equanimity, of course, is one of the things when you're doing travel like this under challenging circumstances that you do get to develop. And I felt that was certainly an opportunity. The compassion piece, I'll share a story. All the other members of the group were able to go up to Vulture's Peak, but Dennis took me aside and said, "I don't think you're going to make this." And he was right. I knew I couldn't do it. So I stayed back, sat on a little bench. And it was a bench, a stone bench, right where people were coming up from the bottom of this hill and then turning kind of in front of me to go up to where the temple was at the top. And I sat there, and there were these two white cows that were just kind of circling me the whole time. I was sitting there and made friends with them. And then people would come up, and I started to notice these families would come up. We had taken the tram, which there's a picture of over here. Very sketchy tram, let me tell you. And we had taken that up to the top. But a lot of the people didn't want to pay the money to do that, so they just walked. And I would notice in these families, you know, the men would all, you know, come up, and there would be an elderly woman struggling up the steps, and no one helping her, not her sons, not her husband, you know. And I thought, well, you know, at first I thought that's an anomaly. And then as I sat there, I saw that same scenario repeated. And the frustration for me was that I could not put compassion into action. I would have leapt up and gone and helped the person if it had been culturally appropriate, which it certainly would not have been. So I had to just watch. And it saddened me. It was, you know, hard to watch that. Contrast that with all the help I got from the other members of the pilgrimage when I needed people coming right behind me, grabbing my bag when it was, you know, too hard for me to walk carrying it. So I got to feel a lot of compassion, and there wasn't much action that I could take, which is frustrating for me because I'm kind of an action-oriented person. But for me, Bodh Gaya was one of the highlights. Just sitting, you know, with our group in the presence of all of these monks, hundreds of monks chanting. I think they were there for some to chant a certain part of the sutta for 10 days and for a few hours in the morning. And it was something that I've never heard and probably never will again. But I found it very helpful in quieting my mind and getting to a place where I could really experience this pilgrimage as a retreat. And it did feel very much like a retreat. And I've taken that experience, well, I thought when we were going home, I thought, well, you know, I'll take a couple of weeks and I'll kind of integrate and, you know, process everything. Well, life intervened, and I got home and found out that a very dear friend of mine needed me to get her to a hospital in the Bay Area for a surgery, and I was like the next day on the road taking her to the hospital, and on the way there my car broke down and was in the shop in Walnut Creek for 10 weeks. And so I had to deal with rental cars and, you know, and getting Sue back and forth, and it was quite an experience. And start a move, because we were starting a final move to Santa Rosa. So I really didn't do much processing. It was only later, a month or two later, that I really began to think about how this had changed my practice, and I rededicated myself to my practice, to sitting more regularly, to finding a group in my new town that I can sit with, in investigating, doing some sutta study, you know, a number of things like that. So it had a profound effect, and probably will for a long time. And what I'll say to any of you that are thinking about doing this, and sort of, you know, letting yourself talk, you know, talk you out of it, if you're anywhere near being, you know, healthy enough to do it, and you know, don't wait. Because I almost said, well, maybe I'll go the next time he does it. I wouldn't have been able to go because now I need a foot surgery. So I am so grateful that I went when I did, because I probably would never have been able to go. So if you're there and it's just your own kind of musings about how difficult this would be, the difficulty is nothing. It really is. It's, you know, think about going camping or something, you know. it's no harder than that. It's no harder than that. And it's a life-changing experience. So I do hope that many of you will take the opportunity. And even if you're 65 like me, you can do it. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so we'll get the next group up. I think Chris's desire for action apparently was fulfilled immediately when she got back.
Yes,
compassion for action. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay, so we get about a half hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
People give their names.
Sure. Yeah. So, okay, whoever wants to start. So Kathy. Kathy, Renee, Jerry, Gus.
I'm gonna have to leave.
Okay. All right. Thanks a million for coming. Huh? Yeah, it's great.
Thank you.
Okay, see you soon.
So my name's Kathy, and it's hard to know how out of this whole enormous experience you can kind of extract something that will seem meaningful. But I think one of the things I was thinking today is that there was a sense over the whole trip of being the recipient of this enormous generosity. I mean, certainly from the group, every single person that we went with at some point or another gave me some huge gift, whether it was a teaching in a moment when I really needed it, or some really seemingly small act of kindness that really wasn't so small after all, and all the opportunities that we had to be with one another under lots of different circumstances. But then it wasn't just that group. I mean, there were these moments where complete and utter strangers gave us these just unbelievable gifts. So Jerry knows what I'm going to say, because I can see he's laughing at it. So, I mean, so there are all these serious stories, so I'm going to tell a light story. So we were at the Mahabodhi Temple, which was at the very beginning of the trip, and we would do alternating sitting and walking. So we had done some sitting, and we were getting up to go walking, and we experienced something that it turned out was pretty common, actually, later, which was that people would come up to you, and since we were pretty unusual kind of folks among all the people who were there, people would come up and kind of want to be with you and then want to get their picture taken with you. So, but we didn't really know that. We were just starting out. So Jerry and I were kind of near each other and we were getting up to go walk. And this man came up who had this like gorgeous baby, this like little probably 9 or 10 month old girl who was all like totally decked out in this beautiful white dress. So we were just kind of getting up to go do our thing, and this guy comes up to us with this baby, and he wants to take our picture, right? So, I mean, that was, we didn't really have any way to talk, we didn't have any language in common with him, but it was pretty clear pretty soon that that was what it was about. So he came up and he kind of stood next to us, and then I don't remember even who had the camera, but first it was with Jerry, and then they came up and stood next to me, and then the whole thing just sort of got even more intense. And then he comes up and he just like gives me the baby. So I mean, it's this beautiful baby. So I'm holding this baby. It's pretty nice. And then he wants to take a picture of me holding the baby. And then he wants to take the picture of us together. So the thing that was really too bad is that nobody we knew got any pictures of him. But our picture is somewhere. Jerry's and mine and this baby is somewhere. In India, right? In somebody's, I don't know, family album or whatever.
But, Grandma and Grandpa from America.
But the thing, I mean, it was funny, but it was just holding this baby was so sweet. I mean, it was just like the nicest thing. And then, at a certain point, we had to give the baby back. So I guess I gave him back the baby. And then, so we couldn't talk to him. But you know, I wanted to. It was just this lovely little moment. So I thanked him. And then he did something that actually I'd never seen anybody do before or since. Instead of just namaste bhakti, he did this thing where he, like, put his hands over his heart and just gave me this expansive farewell. And that was just this beautiful little moment. So that's my story.
India was just a place of contradictions, where, you know, you do see that poverty, and then out of it comes, you know, just love and compassion that's just sometimes you just don't see here as readily. As you've heard from other people, you know, we were preparing for a long time, and one of the things I toyed with over the year before leaving was, you know, we knew we were going to be, you know, people, we'd be bumping into people, or people would be doing things for us, and I wanted to be able to reciprocate somehow. And so I spent the year making little felt toys and some little Buddhas, not Buddhas, but Bodhisattvas. And so I ended up jamming my bag full of felt and little felt people. And so on the bus I was felting. And then so I had like little geckos and turtles and fish and penguins. And so whenever, especially with the children, you know, because the children are used to getting, you know, either money or candy. I guess candy's the big gift that people like to give, right? And that's what they're asking for, is candy. And I'd give them this little toy, and at first they're like, okay. and then there's like a moment of delight, right, when they figure out, you know, that it's like a toy, and it's you know, and that they get to keep it. And so that was just really it was fun to have my way of giving back to the people who were there, and some of the people who were helping us. So I had a Calm was one of our first tour guide people, and I was talking with him in a quiet moment, and found out that his dad was actually a monk himself. So I thought that was pretty cool, and he had helped us through a lot of things and took us to a bunch of places. And so at the end of the trip with him, it was a couple of days, I gave him the little monk. So that was pretty cool. One of the things that that I really enjoy now that I'm back is you know, every time I'm reading the scriptures, you know, it starts off, you know, thus I have heard in Ananda Pindaka's park, you know, and I'm like, wow, I was there. I really there. And all these other, Jesus Grove, all the places, right? There's a handful of places that they're always always coming up in the scriptures, and it's like, wow. Yeah. We were there. we were practicing there. Like Dennis said, we weren't just buzzing through. Yeah, we were there. We practiced. We were on the grounds. We spent days and days doing our practice. And then the last thing, three jewels, is since we've been back, the people that we went, when I see them, you know, we're like family, you know. I mean, we just are light up and they say, hi, man. I mean, I come here now and it's like a family reunion every time, you know. It's so tight and nice and sweet. So.
I say ditto to everything that's been said. All those stories, that's all true, and I actually don't have any more stories. I was so skeptical at first. I mean, the idea of going to India was not high on my list, and I was pretty skeptical about it being a retreat. And this is kind of how Dennis builds it up. He says, "Oh, we're going to go on a retreat to India." Nah, moving around, talking, changing places, all that. I didn't think so. And so with that thought, we fly into Bodh Gaya and we get off the plane, and it's so true that India is so big and it's so intense. The moment you step out of the plane and you kind of see the smog and it's kind of dirty and everything, but it's just huge, and it does just kind of hit you. And then you take a drive from Gaya Airport down to Bodh Gaya, down to the temple, and you're going, wow, oh my God, look at these roads, look at how this is doing, look at all these people, look at all this stuff. And, you know, we've seen National Geographic and everything. It's 100 times more than that, you know. You start out that way. And then you go to the temple, and there's 500 or 1,000 monks sitting there daily, starting early in the morning and going until noon or maybe a little bit after that, just chanting continuously. You know, I mean, it's just beautiful. And then you start practicing, you know, and we stake out a place on the temple grounds, and we sit down, and we're meditating, and I think all of a sudden, geez, we're meditating with these guys. The monks, you know. We may not be chanting, we're certainly hearing the chants, you know. So it was, every day was like that. You know, every day we were going somewhere and sitting and practicing and doing Buddhism, you know, if I can say it that way. So, pretty different. I mean, this but like the tourist part of me really, I was just so fascinated by all of that scene. And now here's my practice, a meditation practice, and I'm participating with people from all over the world. So I was blown away from day one, and it just got better after onward. So the adventure stories that we're hearing and everything, so let's see. Taking it, I got all worried because I didn't think I had enough malaria pills with me. Right. So I go out one morning and I go, okay, I'm gonna go to a pharmacy that you can buy. Well, you gotta find a pharmacy. I get in a tuk-tuk, a bicycle-driven tuk-tuk with a guy, and we negotiate a price. And I've already gotten directions from the guy at the desk in the hotel, so yeah, I want to go that way, and I got a little pill bottle, and I'm going, that way. You know. It takes me down there, you know. And of course, there's nothing down there. There's no pharmacy down there. So, well, okay, take me back. And on the way, there's a guy, a vendor that I had stopped and actually talked to, who spoke pretty good English. So we stopped at that guy, and he helped interpret. And the tuk-tuk driver goes, oh, yeah, okay, it's over here. So, we go down there. Well, it's way the hell down through the village and around the corner, and now I'm like, where am I? And
there's always, you know, I mean, you know, the India is, in that part of it is so poor, and it's dirty and everything. I'm going, am I safe here? I don't know. And I thought, well, probably. And he gets into a traffic jam, and there's a big hill, and I'm sitting up there on the back of the tuk-tuk, and he's going, and then he's down, getting off his bike, and he's pulling it up the hill. I thought, oh, okay, this can't happen. I got to get down. So I got down and started to help him pull the tuk-tuk up the hill, which he didn't appreciate too much. So I walked, and he pulled it up there, and I went to the top of the hill. I got back. Anyway, so I had this like tremendous trip. I mean, we went to a clinic, and they didn't have anything, and they told them some other place, and we went down around into this incredibly crowded village, and we actually found a place that was kind of a pharmacy, and the guy there made some phone calls, and he said, well, maybe tomorrow. and then the driver took me back, you know, and I mean, and I paid him 8 times what I had negotiated with him, because I just was thankful for him. It was just a huge adventure. I mean, it was great fun, you know. And I really, it just got better from that. I just want to tell one other story. At Rajgir, Ultra Sikh. So, the place we stayed at is kind of a crossroads, but there's this old temple there, and the hotel guy said, yeah, there's hot springs there. So several of us went looking for a hot spring. Right? We walked down into the village, and we walked up these stairs, an ancient building, and there's an ancient Hindu temple up there, and we're looking around, and the shrine's kind of just in disarray and everything, and yet we're hearing people talking and everything, and we looked over and down, kind of carved into the rock, the hill there, and yeah, it's kind of like an open air locker room down there, you know? All guys, no women. I think the women go at different times or something like that. So yeah, the guy said, yeah, you can go down there. So we did. So we went down in there, and underwear only, no nudity or anything like that, you know. And there's water coming out of a pipe, hot water coming out of a pipe in the locker room, and people washing off. And then you go down into this little alcove, and that's where the spring is. It's carved out of the rock, and the water was a little cloudy and everything. And so we were just schooled in sanitation and being very careful about water and eating the right, you know, don't eat anything that you know that you haven't seen cooked and all of that. And so we're looking at this hot spring, and there's all these kids and guys down there. Should we get in that? I went, yeah. So we did, you know. I mean, and sat around. We go down in there, and all the talking stopped as soon as four white guys came down. All the talking stopped, and then it all started up again as soon as we said, "Oh, hey, how you doing?" You know, and just started talking to them, and you know, broke. You know, it wasn't a huge conversation, but it was great fun.
Yes, yeah, so if we were from Hollywood.
and the trip, a huge advancement in my practice, and as you've heard from everybody else, it just it makes a difference when you see how meditation is practiced and how devout people are and how kind and generous everybody is too. I didn't know I have to hold you up. I actually didn't feel threatened the whole trip. I mean, and I couldn't, but yeah, it was great. And I can't tell you, Dennis is a great tour leader and organizes these things, and he's got it down now. After his second, his third one's going to be even more fantastic. So.
And you get to go.
I think I might go back.
Well, you got all the tour of getting there. So I'm just going to tell you about two places. There's a very ancient university called Nalanda, and it was founded in about 700, and it was burnt to the ground in 1200 by Muslims. But the thing that's shocking is when you arrive there, and that I'm not saying that to denigrate anybody, that's historical fact. But the thing is, you arrive, you see these bricks and things all kind of built up. And we had a great tour guide who spoke great English, and he knew the microscopic details of everything. But so he told us about everything, you know, about all the holes in the ground and everything. But the first thing you discover is this whole place was actually not there. It had been dug up. So a lot of India that we saw, at least that I was interested in, just had been destroyed. And so it's all ruins, except for this stupa, which the British peeled the top off to see what was in it. And they realized this is, we better stop doing this. But Nalanda was important to me because of the teachers that I have come from there. They walked from there up into Tibet and, you know, taught there and then, you know, came down to me eventually. So the tour guide that took us down down below the surface of the earth into some of the areas that had been there, you know, when it was normal walking distance. It wasn't all buried in the dirt. So we went into a cell, and that cell was Padmasambhava's cell. And some of the other really incredible teachers that we still venerate today. So I went into that cell, and there was this little hole in the wall. And this little hole in the wall was where he and some other people would crawl in there and meditate. And this little teeny hole in the wall behind all these bricks. And so the thing that struck me, first of all, was, damn, that's where the guy meditated and became this really incredible teacher, and I could go in there too. And so I crawled in there too. It didn't happen. Anyway, it was wonderful to be there. So that was my first story. So, you know, the second story that I'll try and make brief too was in a place called Krishnagar. I hope I have this right. It's where the Buddha died. And you have the reclining Buddha. He's over there. You can see him wrapped in gold on the wall. And the thing that struck me, first of all, my group was very generous in helping me, because I was kind of ill at the time, helped me get over there and into the place. And so I was walking on, and the thing that struck me first was, first of all, the size of it was very large. But, and I think there were different takes by different people, but I was very impressed by the fact that the Buddha lying there looked dead. He looked real dead. And he looked like he'd been sick, you know, but still tuned, if you know what I'm saying. Obviously, he was an enlightened man, but he was a human being, and he had died there. And you could see this. And that was very important to me at that moment, to see that. And I've had many discussions with Dennis and others about, you know, he died of a stomach issue, a very, very serious one, killed him. And so how did he handle his suffering, which was of great interest to me at that time. And the other thing that got me, and I'll just conclude with this, is I was looking at him, and there was a little kind of curved dirt thing down, you know, right, like he was playing like this, and it's this little thing like there. And the thing that was interesting about this was there was a little Buddha about this big, and it looked like it was going through an arch. And it didn't look like it was facing out. You know, so what you were looking at was a little Buddha figure kind of going through this arch, through this space. And it occurred to me, I mean, nobody told me this, but I made this up because I thought it was a nice story. I mean, it made sense to me, is that what this was is a little statue or a little demonstration of death. The Buddha entering into Parinirvana, and this was an illustration of what we were seeing here. And it was, to me, it was quite ancient. To me, you know, I don't, who knows, but it looked very old. And I was very, again, very taken by that. And I've never gotten that out of my mind at all. So, thank you.
Oh, I can do this fast. I wasn't going to say anything, but I just got too excited when I heard it.
Yeah, hot spring story, right?
So, I'm sure that Jerry actually was in Ganges water and somehow did not get sick. I'm just amazed. One of the amazing things about the trip, it's everything. It's spiritual. It's fun. It's scary. It's rewarding. It's just everything all in one. And I want to mention, like, on a humorous note, we took a tour. Now, these areas are Hindu, and the temples are are Buddhist, but you're in Hindu territory. So, like, our guides were Hindu, the people we talked to were mostly Hindu. So we had one guy that did an amazing job walking us around and giving us the history of the Buddha, which, of course, we already knew, but, you know, it's always fun to hear it. And then at the end, he wraps it up with, now you understand that Hinduism and Buddhism are really the same religion. Buddhism is for lazy people that don't want to memorize the Hindu gods' names. we sat there, and nobody laughed outright, but you could just see this, their lips. Everybody was thinking the same thing. Oh, my God. But that's the kind of things you experience. And the trip is really fun. It's also really scary. It does force you to shed some of the armor that we wrap around ourselves during our daily lives. The people are amazing. If Jeff were here, he would talk about a 16-year-old lady we met, Poona. She's going to school. This is in Varanasi. We met her. She was selling postcards. And we already were up to our ears in postcards, and we're used to telling people no. But he and I both noticed when this lady came up, I mean, she was just sharp as a tack. She's cute. She's really smart. And so we started chatting with her. And I said, I'm not really interested in postcards. The only thing I'm going to buy here is silk. And she goes, well, my uncle was a silk dealer. Mm-hmm. So she's leading us now through these back alleys in Varanasi to her uncle's house. And we met her uncle. He made us sit down for tea, and we chatted for 20 minutes. She called her, got a hold of her father, who was in temple, and they pulled him out so he could come meet us. And we became part of the family. We spent an hour there, maybe, and I bought a scarf. Jeff wanted his wife to see the stuff, so we went back to the hotel, and then she came back with us, and she ended up buying some things too. And they wanted me to show the wife, Jeff's wife, how good the quality was. I didn't have quite enough money on me, and they said, well, don't pay us now, pay us later. And we just walked off with their merchandise. I mean, that's how trusting these people were. They were just, the people are just amazing. Yana. Okay. So wherever, the experiences are just unbelievable. So here's one of them. Wherever we were in all the temples, they have some number of dogs that hang out. And the dogs are pretty mellow as long as they're not talking to each other. With people, they're fine. Mm-hmm. But I noticed every time we meditated, the dogs liked the feeling that they were getting, and they would come up to us while we were meditating and just lay down. But they always circled us and then laid down next to Yana. So she's got the Kvorka or whatever it was. And the dogs knew it. But, I mean, those are the kinds of, and to me, I was just fascinated with that you can predict. We'll sit down, and a dog will come up and sit next to Yana, and it always worked. You know, I mean, the experiences are amazing. And that leads me to the final one, is the Sangha, the friends, the people. We're in a place where we can become very uncomfortable very easily. It's an unfamiliar situation. Things go wrong constantly. You know, the train doesn't come for 5 hours, so you take the bus, and the bus breaks down in the middle of the road, and they can't fix it. I mean, these are the things that you just learn to deal with, and somehow you get through them. But we get through them because we're with each other, and you get to know your family very well. And like somebody else said, I mean, you know, anytime I see one of the people from the group, I just smile. It just makes me feel good to be near them. Because you have become so dependent, we have all become so dependent on each other to help us through, and we know that as long as we're there, no matter what terrible thing happens, yeah, the bus breaks down in the middle of the night, we may end up sleeping on the road, but it'll be okay because we're with each other. And to me, I think that to me is as important as anything I learned on this trip. So, anyway.
Thank you.
So, you know, if you have any interest in going on the 216 one,
my email is on the handout, and then I think I'm now on, what is it, Dennis@sectoinsight.org, whatever the website's down, so, or you can just go up on the website. But so if you are, let me know sometime in the next 6 weeks. For those people who are interested in this point, we'll have a meeting to talk about it. And you know, you can hear from this that it's a real team sport. And the one thing that I think struck all of us was of everybody there, and this sounds very narcissistic, but Western Buddhists tend to be very narcissistic. You know, by the end of this trip, we really felt that like we were owning all the places that we went to, because we'd come in and day after day we'd sit and practice, you know, all morning long, and everybody else would come in and kind of do a whistle stop, you know. And it was really interesting because you could see people seeing that in us. And there would be people who were practicing who wanted to just be near us, mm-hmm. you know, and practice near us. So there's just so many rich aspects of it. But that, for me, that was a real validation of what we were doing, you know, mm-hmm. that like we were really owning our practices and owning it in the place where we should be, you know, and then bringing it back with us.
I think we were the only Western group in most of the places, if not all.
Yeah.
And we were treated very nicely.
Yeah.
I mean, they respected what we were doing.
Yeah, really well.
So. I have one, just because of talking about family, we should mention Sean in the room. Our bus driver in India just took such good care of us, and including waiting around for the 4 hours we waited to get on the plane to go into Nepal. But he was just amazing. I just was thinking about how... He was part of our family, too.
Yeah. His picture is over here. And many of us have so much affection for him. And the care that he gave us is that we've continued to help him. His wife just had a surgery for cancer, and we raised a bunch of money and wired it over to him, you know. So, mm-hmm. So. Okay. So, listen, we're out of time. Thank you very much for sticking around. And